big data and how we can turn that into decisions. I think all of you are excited as well. So please give Dr. Andreas a round of applause.
Hello. Good. So if you take one thing from this talk, then it is that there are four levels. At the bottom level, there's a data set. Above that, tool set. Above the tool set, the skill set. So here, as Sassin, we of course try to teach people skills. But none of this matters if the mindset isn't there. So what is this mindset of big data? Big data is so big that it even goes away, that we don't even think about it anymore. Just like the air. You don't think about the air unless you worry about the PM2.5, of course. So the mindset of big data is the mindset of that data simply is there, it doesn't cost anything, and that's where Ajahn Piaget suggested this question. If you had all the data in the world readily available at your fingertips, what actually would you do with it? So here's how I structure my talk. I will tell a little bit more about the mindset of data literacy. And when I was preparing for this talk, I realized that this is pretty much the mindset of a physicist. Then I'll give you some examples, for instance, order of magnitude calculations or trade-offs. And then I dive into one of the many concepts which are important, namely the concept of transparency. That you, of course, want to see everybody else's data, but you don't want them to see your data. And so that doesn't work. So how actually do we negotiate transparency? And then I'll also point out some myths, some things we want to believe in that are simply false. And I'll point out some illusions that we have. It would be nice if it was the case, it just isn't the case. And then at the end, I'll spend a few minutes talking about the executive course I'm giving here in Sassin at the beginning of March, March 2nd and March 9th, and I'll talk about some of the speakers who I managed to rope into coming and helping me out. If you have any questions, do interrupt me. Otherwise, we have the chance afterwards with Ajahn Piaget that we have a little chat and then we open up for anything you have, and I'll be there for the rest of the day. I thought I'd first tell you a little bit about myself. I am from Germany. I did my undergrad degree in physics, in experimental physics at CERN in Geneva. And that was before the web was invented. It was at the time in the late 80s when people were thinking about the web, but as you know, it only came into being in 94. At that stage, I had done my PhD at Stanford, and I did my PhD in something called artificial intelligence, or AI. Specifically, I worked on neural networks for prediction. At the time, there were very few of us. It was my PhD advisor and another couple of people. That was the world of neural nets back then in the 80s. Now, of course, everywhere you go, neural nets are seeing you. All the face recognition you see on your phone, etc., have all neural nets or deep learning into it. And I was simply lucky that I went to a place and I thought this guy is good and I liked the idea of learning from data that I ended up doing that. No deep calculation on this. I just thought that's something I was genuinely interested in. So my advice to the students here is just do something which you are genuinely curious about and genuinely interested in and be good at this, and all the rest will fall into places. I was then, as Ajahn Piaget mentioned, assistant professor in computer science and cognitive science, but an associate professor at NYU in the business school, because they figured out that if they hire a physicist, maybe they have a chance, that was in the mid-90s, maybe they have a chance to learn what's happening on that web and in analytics and all of that. The good thing was I started two companies at the time. One of them was doing music recommendations. The other one was in the financial space, and David Shaw, who revolutionized Wall Street by having this quantitative hedge fund, David Shaw actually financed the second company. And then 9/11 came, the company folded, didn't know what to do, and then the phone rang. And Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, which was a few hundred people at that time, he heard about me from David Shaw. David was Jeff Bezos' boss before Jeff started Amazon. I should have mentioned that. Jeff said he wanted a chief scientist. And I figured, what? They're selling books. Why on earth would they need a scientist to sell books? But I went up to Seattle. Jeff met with me and explained to me what he had in mind. The scientific method, which is formulating hypotheses and then designing experiments, is the way to make progress. And him being the richest man in the world now, maybe that says that there's something right about that. And he wanted somebody who is an experimental physicist who doesn't run away from data, but runs towards data, who was willing to help him educate him a little bit and help him with the data strategy. Again, I was thinking, at a bookseller, what is he talking about, data strategy? So I asked him what the point is. I said, well, you know, if we want to answer the questions you're asking, then we have to have the data. So you have to help us make sure that the data is there. And also, we want to ask better questions than we asked before. So again, data helps us ask better questions. And then I wonder, what actually is a good question? And he said, good question. What it actually means is, a good question is a question which shows you the underlying space, the axes, trade-offs you need to make explicit. So anyways, I signed up and I moved up to Seattle, and we worked to automate things that you make the implicit explicit, and then you can actually run a business like Amazon. I sometimes wonder what he learned from me. And I think it really is the physicist's way of thinking about the world. I want to give you the counterexample from last week. In Davos, at the World Economic Forum, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said, "The time to do so is ripe, as we all know that for decades to come, it will be digital data driving our economy forward. We had better act now, because coming into being every single day is more than 2.5 quintillion bytes of data, which is, according to one estimate, as much as 250,000 times the printed material in the US Library of Congress. A delay of 1 year means we'll be light years behind." That was the Prime Minister of Japan in Davos last week. I would have asked him, excuse me, what is a quintillion? Because I actually didn't know what a quintillion is. Google does, and Google says it used to be 10 to the 30, it is now only 10 to the 18. Minus 12 orders of magnitude, it's quite a big difference. This for me is an example of a person, in all due respect, who is totally data illiterate. Probably just as data illiterate as Trump. Versus my boss in Germany, Angela Merkel. She has a PhD in physics. This would not happen there. Here is how Angela Merkel would argue about this. She would say, let's start from first principles. How many people in the world? Roughly 10 to the 9, a billion. Okay? How much data does everybody produce in a day? Well, at least one picture on Facebook. So that would be about a megabyte. So 10 to the 6. 10 to the 9 plus 6 is 10 to the 15. Give it another factor of 10 for all the surveillance videos, and there we are. We have the 10 to the 16, which is within a couple of orders of magnitude what he probably meant when he talked about these quintillions. So I want to contrast to you how a physicist thinks about the world, just making simple assumptions and understanding what they mean versus what a politician says about the world. I want you, as business people, as students, I want you to have the mindset of a physicist, which is to think about how can we do things from first principles. All right, that was just one example of data literacy. To generalize a little bit, I think an important part is to understand whether you are right almost all of the time. So for example, if you are creating an airplane or an automated car, self-driving car, you really want to be right. We call it 1 minus epsilon, which is very few mistakes. Or I know that some of you are from financial institutions. If I go to KBank, or I'd like to get some money out, and they say, we can't find your account. So sorry, we must have lost it. That should not happen very frequently. So that's 1 minus epsilon. Versus on the other hand, if you write apps, If you have some ideas, then you should be in a 0.5 plus epsilon regime, where if you're slightly better than chance, go for it. And these are very different mindsets. And one thing I remember explaining to Jack Ma was, if you get a 1 minus epsilon person who gets high on looking at what exception handling can I write into the code, if you ask him to be a glue programmer on just, you know, undefined questions, he will quit. And vice versa, the data scientist, he will quit if you ask him to write production code. So these are very two different mindsets. And as we are talking about this skill set, which is built on the tool set and the data set, we have very, very different people for those two different tasks. Anyways, I want to point out that I spent 3 years of my life, longer than I spent on my PhD, writing up those stories in that book called Data for the People. And to my amazing surprise, it managed to be a bestseller in Thailand. It came out in December. They ran out of books. They reprinted it. I just learned yesterday. So I am just amazed how curious people here are. And I'm very grateful to Brandlu, the publishing house, for having done such an amazing job. And why do I call it Data for the People? Because that mindset of data literacy, I want to be very empowering. Empowering means that I don't want data which we produce, and we have very little choice there, to be used against us. You know, you could imagine that an insurance company sneakily takes the data and just cranks up your premium. I want us to be in charge of our data. I want data of the people and by the people to be data for the people. One of the important things in the book is that I want to point out the illusions we have. So you hear people say, oh, we should be in charge of our data. Or we hear people say, oh, we should actually control what data is generated about us. That is an illusion. We have no way to try to control data at the source. What we have way is that we can have rights against the data which others produce. For example, the right to see my data. I invite you to go to Google location history and marvel with the amazing amount of precision. You have years back of your life, every single point. It's just amazing. But it's also a good example of seeing how mistakes can happen. I gave a talk at Columbia University with a computer, and I said, oh, let's look at my location history. And I was staying at a friend of mine in Manhattan, and there was a point in the middle of the night where it said that I was sighted in Weehawken, New Jersey, on the other side of the river. Like, I say I'm in Bangkok side, and then there's a point on Thonburi side. We're in the middle of the night. So I figured out, how is this possible? And it turns out that this base station of the carrier on the other side of the river just picked up the signal and told Google, oh, we just picked up the signal from here. And then Google said, aha, he must have gone there. I just invite you to play with this wonderful interface that Google has so you can see your data. And I'm sure you'll be just as surprised as I have been about how much Google, from so many different data sources, puts together what you do and where you are. One of the questions here is, do we want them to do that? And I think our right has to be to say, well, I should have the right to obfuscate my data. So I say that I should have the right to blur my data. So if I tell Google, I only want you to process my data on a 1 kilometer radius, well, then if Google doesn't do that, if Google sends you that coupon to the shoe store next to the other shoe store, or the massage place on Siloam next to the other massage place, then I can say, dear Google, this was not okay, because I told you only 1 kilometer resolution. But as a data scientist I am, I say, I also expect people to be consistent with what they want the data refineries to do. So if I tell Google, to stick with that example, only 1 kilometer radius of precision, and then order Food Panda. How will the poor Food Panda person know where I am if I tell, do not tell anybody? He will bring my food to somebody else within a 1 kilometer radius. Or the Grab driver. If I tell the Grab driver, oh, I'm not telling you where I want to go. We just should be clear of how we negotiate those things, and we should hold companies accountable for what it means that we have our rights. That's the book, Data for the People. Then there's the opposite side of that. And that I call people for the data. Haha. And that is, what should people who work in companies that have data, what should they know so they can do a good job in leveraging the data mainly for the benefits of the company and hopefully not against what the individuals who the company has the data of want. One of the tools in the toolset of a physicist are so-called thought experiments. One thought experiment I invented at Amazon is to say, normally you need to ask for permission if you want to share data. If you want to share data within the firm, especially if you want to share data with the outside world. So now I want you to flip that sign and think, what if you lived in a world where you had to ask for permission if you do not want to share data? How would that change things? How would you do things if that was the case? For example, Deutsche Bank. A friend of mine was a chief technology officer there, and he radically said, everybody at Deutsche, so everybody who is an email with @db.com, can see every single email he gets and every single email he writes from his Deutsche Bank account. Wow. What do you think happened? It turned out that from one day to the next, all of that bickering stopped. The people who he wanted to fire, they left, and the experiment was a huge success. So I like to challenge people's assumption about privacy. We have seen this in geolocation, email, finances, etc. Those are a few of the things which I think are worth thinking when I talk about the mindset of big data. So now, actually, rather than telling you too many more stories here about Amazon and other companies I've worked with, I want to do one more thought experiment with you. Something called Moore's Law has been holding for decades. What Moore's Law says is that everything that has something to do with transistors doubles roughly every 1.5 years. So whether it's the density of transistors in a chip or the chips in a computer, whatever it is, doubling time is 1.5 years, or what that corresponds to, that in 5 years, you have a factor of 10. 5 years, a factor of 10, 10 years, a factor of 100, etc. So a question for you, how many seconds are in a day? A minute has 100 seconds. An hour has 100 minutes. That's 10,000. And a day has 10 hours. So that means a day has 100,000 seconds. After 25 years, you have a factor of 100,000. So, ladies and gentlemen, in 91, 92, I had the honor of teaching a class here at Chula, next door in computer engineering. A class on neural networks, which is crazy in retrospect. What took a day then takes a second now. This mindset of data here is that you think about what you waited for until tomorrow is now within that period. That is pretty amazing. I can barely, but kind of, relate to that. Now comes the most scary fact I learned last year. If you don't look at processing power, memory, etc., but if you look at the cycles, the computer cycles that get put into AI, that factor of 10 is not 5 years. That factor of 10 is not 5 years, but it's only 1 year. That blows us out of the water. The process, the speed in which AI progresses is something which I think none of us can really comprehend. I had a long interview on German television a couple of months ago. They asked the question, and they were clearly shocked by my answer. They asked the question, but does this mean that the computer will know you better than you know yourself? And the answer, of course, yes. If you go on a dating site, I think the dating site knows better than you what you really want. Last few minutes, I want to spend and tell you what I'm doing in those 2 days. The course is called Turning Big Data into Decisions. So big data, we already decided, that's just simply the world we live in. Decisions are irrevocable allocations of resources. So for me, something that doesn't end up in a decision can be nice, you might enjoy it, but from a business perspective, makes no sense. Those of you who are interested in taking the course, I prepared a little survey under bit.ly/sassindata. In the survey, I'll ask you about what decisions you need to make and what data sources you have, but also what data sources you might not have that you might want to have for those decisions. By the way, what is the value of data? The value of data is the impact those data have on a decision. So if somebody sells you data and your decision doesn't depend on the data, how much should you pay for the data? Nothing. On the other hand, Wall Street data is a good example in finance. Another good example is in credit ratings. So the value of data is the impact the data has on decision. So we talk about different data sources, different data types, active data you explicitly create, passive as you walk along the street. And we talk about time scales of data. So that's the first part of the day. Then I'll dive into a case of recommender systems. That, of course, I know very well from Amazon. It is this people who bought X also bought Y. And there are variations of that. And variation, for example, people who look at X eventually buy Y. That's a very powerful one because you take the collective intelligence of 100 million customers who figured out after looking at this, what did they eventually buy? And then you help people make better decisions from their perspective based on the data that you collected from all your customers. Not secretly, every customer realizes that if he doesn't tell Amazon what he's interested in or what he wants to buy, how would poor Amazon be able to ship him that? That is the motivation for the recommender system. And I invite you there to think about what recommender system's role is in society. And specifically, I think about Facebook. Facebook is a major recommender system because there's lots of contents Facebook could show you. But what do they show you? What I'll point out there, making recommendations is easy. Evaluating recommendations is hard. And what Facebook is grappling with is that evaluation function, that cost function, that target function, that objective function, what that should be. Should it only be the profit? Then, of course, show them the weirdest fake news and it's great because people will be more likely to click on weird things than on normal things. On the other hand, maybe democracy has become impossible given how much the Russians actually infiltrated the West. Maybe I should tell you one story. On my birthday, 2.5 years ago, I was invited to Russia to meet with President Putin. And, you know, just Google my last name and Putin, and then you see so many pictures of this event from the front page of the paper that you believe that I couldn't fake that one. Putin invited me to learn about AI and to learn about data. But what was interesting, that in the meeting, another guy, he was the head of the largest bank, of Sberbank, during the meeting, he got a phone call. And I thought, wow, he walked out. The guy took a phone call, and then he came back. And I said, so what was this about? And oh, we had an attack. An attack? Attack? A computer attack. Computer attack. And I thought to myself, computer attacks come from China or they come from Russia? I'm in Russia, so I blew it up. Oh, that must have come from China. And he said, I think, you should think about this again. So that was on the day after the election, after Trump got elected, the American retaliation from the NSA to actually show the Russians that they were not happy with how the interference worked. And I was there with Putin. Anyways, I want to talk about what class is about. So we talk about data sources, recommender system, and then I have a guest in the first day who used to work at Grab. So he's coming up from Singapore. We use Grab as an example of a physical object, namely getting a car from place A to place B, and how that has become a data company that doesn't own any cars, as opposed to your taxi company. But Grab just puts together information, figures out how much to charge, even do a surcharge. That is interesting. I've talked to my friend Rob Rosenstein. He is the CEO of Agoda. So actually, I should say I was an advisor of Agoda. And I probably helped them, well, Rob at least would say that, to really adopt a data attitude. And then we have dinner, very important, at the end of the first day, because I want people who are maybe more quiet in class to have the chance to then informally talk, and we'll be just something simple around here. Then we meet again the subsequent Saturday on March 9th. We have the day getting kicked off by another friend of mine, Kuncharam Porn. I met Kuncharam Porn when he was the CEO of Thai Airways at a workshop I did for all the Starline CEOs. I did a day workshop on data. As you know, he left TG and he now is the director at Bangkok Bank, where he is charged with digital transformation. So I figured that would be interesting for you to hear his stories. That's how we start the second week in the morning. Then I will have another friend of mine, Axel Winter, in the afternoon. And before he moved to Bangkok, he lived in Singapore, where he worked for Standard Chartered, giving the CEO data, and how what the CEO thought would take a week, only taking less than an hour, how that really changed the questions the CEO was asking. Axel now is the CTO of Central Group, and he runs a big team doing technology for Central. And I again think that having somebody who has really built something in the region would be good to bring it home at the end of the second day. That's what I have planned. So the first day is more the perspective of data for the people, March 2nd. The second day, March 9th, is more the perspective of people for the data, of seeing how different organizations here, which are significant, how they actually are making progress, what's easy for them, what's hard for them. All right, so we said I should end at 7:10. It is now 7:10.
Thank you very much. I think let's sit down and let's chat. Okay, that's mine, it's yours. That's good.
Just.
So again, I think I'm very fascinating about the story that you have told. Let me go back a little bit. So before I give the audience the chance to ask you, I have a few of my like personal questions.
Not too personal.
Okay. A while ago you decided to study about data, neural network. What got into that? I mean, that's a long time ago. I wouldn't imagine, right, that people would think that would be something important. So what's really motivate you to do that? I'm just curious.
I got the place to do a PhD at Stanford.
Right.
And I was all set to do it at Slack in physics at the Stanford Linux Accelerator Center. And I went to that class, Introduction to AI, right, Tara Winograd taught. And out of all the papers we read, there was one paper which I really thought was amazing. And that was by David Ruhmelhardt, who became my PhD advisor, who invented neural nets. So I don't know what resonated with me, but it's certainly something where my little brain actually got excited about it.
Right.
And you know, if you're really excited about it, then you work super hard and you get other people to also, you know, feel that excitement.
Got it. I think that's really amazing. Moving on to your, I think, another milestones of your life at Amazon, right? Again, I think that's a very exciting period for you as well. But what would you say it's going to be your kind of like your best maybe like best advice or best things that you did to, you know, transform or really like change Amazon?
Yeah. So Jeff and I spent dozens of hours trying to write down the objective function for Amazon.
Right.
And what I learned from Jeff was the relentless customer centricity. I can't tell you how often, you know, people like me think, oh, there's a way, a sneaky way to get some data. And Jeff always busted it and said, this is not how we do things here. That's why, by the way, when Mark Zuckerberg did this super embarrassing appearance at Congress last year, I know that Jeff would have not done those things. Yeah. And what I helped with was just a sparring partner, you know, a discussion partner, and then sometimes to convince the teams that what Jeff's idea was actually was a pretty good idea. I know it didn't come from them, I know, but the guy's pretty good. And it was all about what metrics should we optimize.
Right. Wow. That's really interesting. And you know, you talk a lot about mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you said that, you know, first level data, right? And then tool sets, and then skill sets, and then mindset. Now, I'm sure you have been, you know, data coach for a lot of, I think, many big companies in the world. But changing mindset is not easy. I'm sure it must be really hard, right? And given that, you know, different countries in the world, China, there's different culture, different way people think. So how you do it? How do you change the mindset of people in the way that you think it will lead to, you know, data for all, or, you know, data for the people?
Yeah. So right now I have the challenge that in Germany, the mindset towards data is a very critical mindset. So if you think about the distribution of possible outcomes,
right?
You know, I'm in Germany and everybody worries, what is the worst case? If everything gets wrong, where are we? And then I hop on the plane, Lufthansa, and land in San Francisco, and people say, oh, what is the best case? If everything goes right, where will we be? And so those are really the two ends of a spectrum. And I think it's important to make it explicit that this is a distribution. And it's important that people get clear that if they're stuck in that mindset, what the downsides are, namely there's no single internet company which has come out of Germany, period. No single company has come out of Germany. They're doing cars there. On the other hand, you have US where you have all these problems with Facebook. So, you know, I want people to become data literate. I want people to make decisions. By the way, one thing in classes, I will not tell you, you must do this, as probably Ajahn Prasad do. I mean, many people, maybe, I don't do that. For me, it's important that people know what the map is, that people understand what the landscape is, and then they should make their own path. They should figure out where they want to go, where they want to be, and then they should find their way in the map. So that is sort of my mindset. And that also applies to data. So in Germany, my task, Angela Merkel wants me to promote a more positive mindset, but it is not easy.
Yeah.
And in China, I had a house in China for 18 years, a condo in Shanghai, which I luckily managed to sell last year, and I need to sell it because I bought a place at Icon Siam. So in order to afford that, I needed to sell my condo in China. And it was interesting how the Chinese have just so locked down on everything. It was not fun anymore in the last few years because of the surveillance. Everything goes through the Great Firewall. It's just tedious. And they, of course, do it in order to make sure that the government persists. In America, politicians do things in order for companies to persist. You know, they do whatever Amazon, Google, right. Facebook ask them. And Germany, I have the hope, and I really think very highly of Angela Merkel, in Germany, Europe, France, I have the hope that people actually do things for the people.
Interesting. So just curious, you said China is not fun. You think moving to Thailand will be more fun?
Sanuk, of course.
So looking forward to that. And about that mindset, I had a conversation with him. And he said this, I think it's very interesting. He said that, you know, we might used to say like, now, you know, the data is a new oil. But he actually has even a better version than that. He said, data is a new soil. What do you think about this? You know, what do you really mean? How can data be even better than oil? But it's a soil.
Different.
Soil for what?
Yeah, different. Yeah. So I think, as you know, in the Davos meetings, we heard that the oil metaphor, or he calls it petroleum, and Thailand oil plays an important role. So oil gets used up. Data doesn't get used up. So the value of oil, once you burn it, is zero. But if I put my data together with your data and with all the other data in a data refinery, like, say, Google, we all have more than we put in. So that is a radical difference between data and oil. Now, why do I like to say soil? Because, you know, it's cute in English, at least. It doesn't work in German at all. But in English it does, and we're speaking English here. And soil means that you have something where things can grow. And so we have to take care of those things that grow. We have to take care of the data that people put in.
Right.
And we have to give them stuff. We have to nourish them. We have to make sure that they actually benefit, that ecosystem works. So in that sense, I think, you know, it's cute, and I thought I had come up with it, but, you know, none of the things I ever say, once you Google it, you turn out to have come up with. Very frustrating. But, you know, I at least had the chance to tell the United Nations General Assembly about it. So, yeah.
Got it. Let me ask you one more thing before I turn to the audience, right? You mentioned a little bit about AI, artificial intelligence, right? And, of course, this is another buzzword, right? And clearly, you know, AI and big data are going to be very important in the future. So what do you think will be like the picture of the world in the future? You know, if you can imagine 10 years from now, so we can have some picture and we can prepare for that. How are we gonna live with AI and with big data?
I do one exercise in class, which is a logarithmic spacing in the past, minus 1 year, minus 3 years, minus 10 years, minus 30 years.
Right.
And then I do the same into the future. And I've come to the conclusion that it really depends on your perspective. You can say nothing really changes, you know? And you can say, gee, everything changes. And Jeff Bezos makes a good point that you have to have the balance between both. Because if you say everything changes, then what you're doing now will be changing too. So that's why his customer centricity is always harping on that, you know, that is not changing. We innovate on behalf of the customer.
Right.
So I think the most important change AI has for all of us, and I don't think it will take 10 years for that, is it will change dramatically how we work. And for me, AI really at its heart is data. So if you had a keylogger that, you know, measures really how you type.
Right.
For instance, I have a big variance. Sometimes I type quite well, sometimes I'm awful. I type 3 characters and then erase 2 of them. And then it's just, so something, I don't know what it is that determines that variation. Or, you know, with the cameras, you can have now, you can have here a company which was bought by Apple 2 years ago, Emotioned, a couple of high resolution cameras, and read out everybody's emotions in this room. So maybe you should do this in the classroom. So if you think about work, sometimes you really like to be close to people. Other times people just get on your nerves. And if you could predict all of those things,
yeah,
how would we want the workplace to look like? So that's one area. The other area I want to mention is healthcare. Every baby born in China now has its DNA sequenced. So China has a database where we know for every newborn what is. In Singapore, by the way, I just learned that everybody gets a bank account. Every baby gets a bank account with $1,000 or so, which is Singaporeans' way of, you know, making sure they can track where the people are. But in China, it is DNA. And what I think the hard questions will be is, what, ladies and gentlemen, what will fairness be in a world where we know everything? So take insurance. Right now, insurance means pooling of risk. That means we don't know. In some cases, we do know the gender, but in the EU, say the gender doesn't matter. And that is the world which we believe, or the EU believes, is a fair world. Sorry, but in the future, that doesn't go very far to say we don't know. So how do we deal with that transition from a world where we basically don't know, and fairness means to roll the dice, to a world where we do know? What will fairness be? And there are some good examples. For example, for people who are waiting for an organ transplant. So you need a liver, yeah, for instance. And then how should you allocate the next liver that is compatible with 10 people? Should you give it to the person who paid most taxes? Or to the person who paid most bribes? Or, you know,
or what?
So in that case, you had a group of doctors, well-meaning doctors, get together at the Mayo Clinic and come up with the objective function. So we measure those things about you, and then we are blind about the individual. Whoever has the highest score gets the next liver. And back to your AI question. There are big intercultural differences. The canonical test is that you ask different cultures, well, here you are in that self-driving car, and you either have to run over that grandma or to run over this little baby. You cannot avoid one of the two things you have to do. What will you do? That's a variation of the so-called trolley dilemma, which is you are in San Francisco in a streetcar, you are the trolley driver, and oh my God, you see that the car is stopped, the brake doesn't work, it's going to run into that group of 100 people who are sitting at the, but you could whirl around and take the other direction, and then you would for sure kill that one person who's standing there. So what do you do? If you take the action, then this person would not have been killed without your action. If you don't take any action, you will tell 100 times as many people. So those are the questions, I think, the questions of fairness and the question of ethics in AI, which are the interesting ones.
Absolutely, they're very interesting. Let me turn to the audience, right? I'm sure that after listening to all that Dr. Andreas have said, I think you have plenty of questions. If you have questions, please raise your hand. And we have an hour team to actually help with the microphone. If you have any questions, please raise your hand.
And it's so bright here that we don't see, actually. I think there's a hand. So just raise your hand, get a microphone.
We have
and
one person in the front here. Oh, okay, yeah. Go ahead, please.
So,
and say who you are, or what you, who you, yeah, work for, or something like that. So
I'm BJ, I'm a SAS alumni. So I had a quick question. What's your view on the singularity?
Singularity. I think irrelevant. So I'm not concerned about that. Singularity U is doing good work, the exponential technology, so that clearly is the case. But I don't think, it's like, for me, first of all, I'll be dead when that's happening. And then secondly, I don't think there will be a specific point in time where something specific happens. That's my view. But just as good as the janitor's view, I mean, you know.
I see. Okay, next, I saw. the microphone in the front, please.
Oh, okay. Whoever has the microphone should speak.
Go ahead.
Okay, great.
Hello, maybe I'm only Japanese. I'm from Nikkei. Thank you very much. I'm very impressive. My question, because I had a dinner with our Nikkei research team, what is the future of the research company under the AIH? And what is the role of the
good people? Good question.
So my idea,
yeah,
because before the AIH, so-called business intelligence,
yeah,
BI system, like SAS, the company, SAS, SAS Institute, I know the company. I know some IBM division working for BI. Before we talking about AI, what I'm thinking as a role of the researcher, the people, not AI,
yeah,
will be the, I would say CI, communication intelligence.
Oh, cool.
Or communication integration.
Or customer intelligence, which might be intelligence about the customer or by the customer.
As a media, I would say AI, BI, followed by CI.
Yeah. Followed by CI.
By CI. For me, it's actually curiosity intelligence. Because if you're not curious, then none of these matter. But then we should add, after ABC comes DI. DI, of course, is decision intelligence or data intelligence. And then comes EI, which is experimental intelligence, and so on and so forth.
You want to go with F? That's amazing.
Okay. So the role of people is, people are vastly overestimated when it comes to research tasks like in finance.
Right.
So we like to think that we are good. So I gave a talk a year and a half ago at Fidelity Investments, which is a large investment firm in Boston.
Right.
And I talked to my friend who was doing payments at Amazon before, and he said, Andreas, I can't believe you'll be doing this. I would pay to be there to see you do that. Right. So, and I did it. So I was a talk, and then I asked people to please each take out a coin. And if they didn't have a coin, they should borrow one from the neighbor. And then I asked them to please now, and no cheating, to now toss the coin 12 times and write down heads, tails, head, but no cheating, okay. Everybody was done. And then I said, okay, I want to know, did anybody get 12 heads? Nobody.
No.
Did anybody get 11 heads? Anybody 10, and there was one guy in the last row who got 10 heads. So I went up and congratulated him for his clear skill of producing 10 out of 12 heads. Just like people in the index who say, out of the last 10 out of the last 12 months, we managed to beat the index. And I think with all these things, we are vastly living the illusion that we are better in financial things or in number things than computers. Ultimately, whoever has the better data, whichever computer has the better data, and the standard example of AlphaGo being here, that even things which are supposed to be very, very difficult for computers, now they are beating people.
Got it, interesting. Okay, next question. I think I saw some hands in the front. Would you, yes?
Hey, hi. Hey, so you know, just more general questions. You know, I think you seem like a very energetic person. So, what keep you, you know, waking up in the morning to do your work, and what keep you awake at night?
Okay. I mean, I think these are very personal questions. So I can tell you that since Icon Siam isn't ready yet, I'm staying at a friend's two-bedroom. And on UDelight in Rama 3, and there are no curtains. So what makes me up in the morning is the sun. What keeps me up at night is maybe telephone calls with the German government because of the time difference. No, it's usually I love having dinner with friends and, you know, going to a nice place. That's usually what keeps me up.
Anything about data? I think that's what you mean.
I think what used to worry me is when you work in a big company there's so much politics, and that I just did not like. And so that used to, but that's not a good way of being kept up at night. So I think I have a pretty much politics-free life, which means, you know, when I go to bed, I tend to sleep. And then in the morning, when the sun comes, I wake up. I don't like to set the alarm. And I like to take a nap in the afternoon, if that counts.
All right, got it. Any next questions? Please.
Hello, I'm Armin from alumni.
All right.
I mean, we've learned that mostly economists, you know, so many of them, right? They're normally quite wrong in forecasting the next crash, financial crash or property crash or political crash. How do you think artificial intelligence can help to forecast the next crash?
So I think, so another of these stories of mine was, when I was at NYU,
right.
I got a call from the CIA, and I was asked whether I can come down to the Washington DC area for a meeting.
Right.
Okay. I was really weird. Mm-hmm. I had no idea why I was invited. The topic of that meeting, it was in, I think, 98 or 99, was the Thai baht crisis. And the CIA was just super surprised that they did not have any intelligence before it happened. So when we looked at things, we actually got some clues. Because Thailand, and you know, I'm not telling the story because I'm Thailand, I'm always telling that story. Thailand stopped reporting some numbers. So Thailand didn't report wrong numbers. They just, you know, some numbers didn't come in. And the models did not worry about numbers not being reported. So that is an example here where the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States of America was wondering why they didn't manage to predict a collapse. And the answer was because they did not notice the absence of data. So that's one story. And then I, at the end of the day, I asked, you know, why me? Why me? I mean, you know.
Yeah. I mean, why you?
And then they told me what the story was. And I do clearly remember the incident. So I was the last year of my PhD at Stanford. Mm-hmm. And I did my PhD thesis was on time series prediction with neural nets. So I saw in the course catalog, which those days was still printed, I saw a course in the economics department on time series analysis. So, you know, being Andreas, I show up. And the guy, his name was Steve Durlauf. And so there were not many of us. There were like five students in the seminar room. And it's a 3-hour class. So we sign up and, you know, I don't have super much patience. So he was talking about the whole decomposition theorem and about moving average. At that stage, I said, excuse me, I have two questions. When you say moving average, one, what are you taking the average on and what's moving? And he said, let's take a break. And I never showed up afterwards. I never showed up. So when this year I was looking at somebody who is, you know, has no respect for authority of authors, that's when Steve Durlauf said, I have this guy, let me find his name. And that's how they got to that.
All right, got it. Very interesting. Okay. Any next questions? If you have questions, please raise your hand. Or Dr. Andres? Yes, we have here.
I'm Osvudov. I'm retired, as you can see.
No, I can't see that. How do you see that?
I was in government for Germany, and I was in charge with the IT section of our government also. And so I'm still studying and advising at the same time. And there's one big hole I found here. You speak about data. And since my start with everything, it was data processing. So I observed for many years that the data grow and grow, you confirmed, but processing capacity did not really change, except for people like you. because you are an absolutely great data processor, because you know what to do with the data. But when I think about our government, certain people, and many others, their capacity to process data, I don't want to say the brain, but even the technology to do so is very limited. So I would say, that artificial intelligence is much better than no intelligence.
Yes.
And this might save us one day. But your predictions include that they might replace us, which is not so bad at all. But do really people in our government, in my parliament, I know them, really understand what is happening? What do you think about the processing capacity of the brains? Just one example, yeah, like you do. We go back to our NSA. In old time, don't exist. Now everybody knows what they are doing. We had our friend who ran away, sits in Moscow now, maybe we met him.
I have a story about Ed Snowden too, yeah.
They panicked immediately, the Americans. Oh my God, this man running away, going to the Russians, our enemies. Oh my God, oh my God. Now we need more reliable people in the future. Now they replaced, now this is a rumor, of course I don't know anything, that they replaced the usual, let's call them easily spies, the researchers, the analysts, the evaluators in NSA, in Utah, by very reliable people, some of them called Mormons. They are religious, they are straightforward, they are brilliant in brains and so on. But they are reliable, or at least people believe so. Do you think they understand you, Thailand, the world, Asia? I have a problem with their processing capacity.
So many questions here. So first, before Angela Merkel appointed me last year in August, I could not have named a single minister in Germany. So I had no idea, and I got it wrong. For instance, in the first meeting, I said something about data, and some guy talked about whether data can be used to suppress, to basically to repress people, I mean, by measuring too much about people. And I was convinced he must be a left-wing guy. But who knows, was Altmaier, who is a Christian Democrat who runs the Wirtschaftsministerium, the economics ministry. So sometimes it's actually very interesting how people, if you don't know anything about them, you just from what they say, get it totally wrong. Interesting enough, they already got a workshop, which I'm doing at the end of March, because they want to know more. So I think people are curious. They have lots of shit to do. I mean, it's amazing. I admire the chancellor, and she is just so charming. And one thing at night, we had dinner, and I was getting tired. So I asked, Frau Merkel, where are you taking your energy from? Where are you getting your energy from? And she says, from you. Because it's just so much fun to have these conversations. I thought that was really charming. And then I said, I had another question. Then she talked about history. And I don't know much about history. And I thought, well, how is it that she makes such well-informed, from my perspective, remarks on history? So I asked her, where do you know this from? And I expect the answer, my staff briefs me so I can say intelligent things after, you know, the speech of the... She said,
what did you say?
Wikipedia.
Ah.
So that's just so charming. I think there is hope that people are curious, that they want to know stuff. But for one Angela Merkel, you have 100 people who are not that way.
Right.
Yeah. So in general, the answer on the processing, curiosity drives the world. And I think that if we are curious about something, it's amazing what processing power we can do. The couple of companies I started, when I started those companies, I still, 20 years later, remember hour by hour what we did and what people said, because it was just such an amazing experience. On the other hand, there were months of my life when I have to look at Google Maps at my location history to even remember where I was.
Any more questions, please? Yes.
So what I propose in interest of time is we listen to whatever, 5-10 more questions,
and then
we pick whichever one
we
think are best. So everybody has a chance, and we get actually to do what we think is of most interest to all. Is that okay? Is that acceptable?
Right. So I have to interrupt. introduce me?
Yes, please.
I used to work for a big company like PDT, SEG, TBS, and Vivian. Now I work in the fintech.
Fintech.
Yes. And but my father do own the company, the small to medium sized construction company. So my question is, can you give us a suggestion for the SME where to start to implement the data? Because you know we have to start from the scratch, and most of the SME, the age of the owner is about 40 or something. So they, I think 90% of them still don't have the awareness of the data or how important it is. Because from people from my age, we do have, for them, we have to, I think they have to start from the scratch. So can you give them a suggestion?
Got it. Okay.
Let's take the next one. I saw some hands over here. Go ahead, please.
My name is Quinn, I'm an alumni. So we're discussing about all this AI and big data. So what happened is all these technologies will replace a lot of jobs.
Yeah.
For example, like when autonomous car come, all the drivers, they are out of job. And the fact is, all these technologies will replace simple tasks, right? So all the simple tasks, we can use all these technologies to do it. But what happened is, in the future, how the young generation should prepare themselves that in the future, all these technologies will take all the simple tasks. Mm. But the fact is, all those who just graduate, they have to start somewhere. And most of them will start at a simple task. And they step by step go on the ladder. So how should they prepare themselves to jump over all these simple tasks and start with some medium skill tasks while they don't have work experience?
Okay, got it.
Great question. I promise to answer it.
Yes.
But let's listen to some more questions.
Yeah, go ahead. I think we have over there.
Hi, so I'm from the medical field and we work in the in vitro diagnostics. So I work a lot with chemistry, immunology, hematology. Now, our company has gathered an immense data from the Thai population on the patient history and also the blood test outcomes.
Yeah.
And I know this data can generate a lot of immense value in terms of predictive analytics on the Thai healthcare. The big question that our company's been trying to ask for a long time is, how do we get started on working on this data? Because as simply as applying machine learning to, say, our set of data, for us, it's not a very practical thing to say. The practical thing to say is, what kind of software should we use to work with our set of data? Or who or what should we hire to work with our set of data?
Thank you. Maybe we take two more?
Two more?
Okay.
Great.
I saw some hand.
I think, lady, we have had
so
far only the guys
one
here.
One and one.
Yeah.
Okay. You in the back, yes, go ahead.
Over here. So I work for Save the Children. And so my question is, now that we're moving to the world of big data, a lot of times the data are being used against us as well, and they're being collected without us actually knowing that they're being collected. So my question is, what are the big companies doing or the governments are doing to ensure protection to customers' data, and what's being implemented around the world right now?
Got it. Thank you.
Yep.
And then we have the ladies in the front. Over there.
Or whoever has the microphone.
Hi, I'm Mila from White of the Bank. I'm the banker. So I'm curious about what do you think about the social credit system, like in China?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so would it create more the gap between the high score and the lower score? And the gap would be different than the gap in capitalism. Mm.
Okay.
Yes. So I think I'll take them in somehow reverse order because, so let's talk about the social credit system in China. First of all, I want to bring people in how it works. So there's a company called Alibaba that also owns Ant Financial. And I think this is the innovation the world has seen in the last 10 years is Alipay. So it's just crazy how 1 billion people absolutely changed the behavior. So much for the positive. Now, the government has mandated that I think by, is it 20, 22, I think, in a few years from now, that there is a social credit score. And I invite everybody to look at what the terms are that they're entering that social credit score. So I sat down with an interpreter in Beijing and had her actually translate it for me. For example, part of that social score is, are you visiting your parents regularly? Because that's what the law says. So I am visiting my mom regularly. She's 93 now, not that young anymore. But I mean, I just think if I visited her, because otherwise my social credit score would go down. I mean, that seems like the wrong motivation. So what I really applaud the Chinese government for is to come up with a pretty broad view, a pretty broad objective function, and to publicly discuss that. So that's great. The two things I have issues with is, one, the use of it for social control. So for example, if I post something critical, and it turns out Ajahn Piaget is a friend of mine, Ajahn Piaget's score might also go down. And that might mean that he cannot take the high-speed train from Shanghai to Beijing anymore, but needs to take the bus. But luckily, there is hope for him. If he has a conversation with me, and I say, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, I didn't mean to post a critical comment about Mr. Xi Jinping, then his score will go back up.
Very good advice.
So that, of course, is just going way too far. What also I think is going way too far is, I agree that there are many scarce resources that we need to negotiate as society, like the, you know, the school next to Chula, people, Chula itself, you know, Sassin. These are all scarce resources. But if your parents don't say the right things, should a smart child not be allowed to go to a good primary school anymore? Seems difficult. So I think I applaud them for having that conversation. But of course, it's a totalitarian regime. As we already said, the purpose is to make sure it sustains itself. So I think there is room for improvement. But I think it's better to have the conversation than to just simply do it under the table. Making the implicit explicit is what I would say is a great approach. And China as a technocratic society, of course, is. Now, if you know how it works in practice, you'll see it's quite different. So you have a score. If you are caught for fare evasion, this means you're not paying for MRT, then minus 5 points. And they do this with face recognition. It gets automatically deducted. If you are caught with shoplifting, minus 20 points. And what if you are caught with selling counterfeit goods on Taobao? Plus 100 points. Because, you know, you clearly understand how the system works. Plus you make Alibaba some money. Medical field question. There it is, I think, not about the tools you buy. It is about the questions you ask. So I don't know much about medicine. But I think you need to start with, what is the problem you're trying to solve? Because otherwise, with all these blood samples, I think you will not have much, you know, hope for actually insights. So at Amazon, you know, it's always questions first or hypothesis driven scientific method. And so that would be my answer to the medical field. To the first question with the SME, very simple, take the class. March 22nd and March
9th. Yeah. All right. Very good advice.
So finally, the question you had. How to prepare for this world or something like that. So I have always fared well. So people, I mean, many of my students at Berkeley, they say, oh, Andreas, what should I do? Should I work for a big company or small company? Should I do this, that, and the other? And I always say wrong question. For me, even if somebody says, should I do a PhD? Or should I do it with this professor? I said, you know, first question is, what do you really want to do? And I cannot force myself to work on something which I'm not interested in. I mean, just not happening. If you ask me to teach a class, I mean, I actually like teaching, so I can get interested in many topics. But I mean, like training people, I know, I'm sorry, you know, I'd rather go and have a beer or something. But the most important question, I think, is who will you be working with on a daily basis? That for me is a question most people underestimate the importance. So I'm a people person, and I can work very hard if I, you know, appreciate the other person, respect the other person. Like Angela Merkel or Jeff Bezos are clearly people who actually have my deep respect.
Yes.
So I think that would be my answer to your question. Not so much worried about what the future of work will look like, but do you want to work with a person? And will they be like a mentor to you? Will they share with you, you know, how to do things? Or do they just try to exploit you as a code monkey to write code? And this mentoring, I think, is a very important distinction between Germany and US. You know, when I was at the Ministry of Economics and I was thinking about what to do the workshop on in March, I actually want to do it about mentoring, because in Silicon Valley, that really is a great thing. For example, Ajahn Mickey, who teaches at Chula, he asked me last year to help him with a data safari where we took some Chula students who right. came over on a trip. And, you know, I think that is a mentoring element where you then try to make sure they have a good experience, they learn.
Right.
That's what money can buy. So we went to eBay, for instance, where the chief scientist, an old friend of mine, gave a talk. I mean, you don't pay these people. I mean, they do it because they want to share. And the most moving of all these was at Google, where Peter Norvig, who wrote this AI textbook, where he, you know, just simply stayed in the evening and just really just shared and was there to help them. So I think that for me is how society should look. Like for those of us who are retired, we should think, where do we find people who actually, where do we have matches that they want to learn what we can share, and we want to share it with them. So I think that is sort of how I would answer your question and broaden it a bit, is trying to bridge the age gap. And also, one thing I told Angela Merkel was she should find some neighbor's son, 16-year-old or something, and sit down with him once a month for an hour and have him teach her stuff about Instagram, etc. She shouldn't hire McKinsey to write a report. She should just sit down with the son of the neighbor and say, okay, now my attention is yours. What can you teach me? So this reverse mentoring, I think, is a very important way. And we are lucky at universities where we have grad students, where we have students who actually show us how to really do things.
Wow. That's really great, really good. I think, you know, we have learned a lot. One final thing I would like to ask from you. Can you say a few words about the sessions on March 2nd and March 9th? So it's going to be technical. I know you said about what you're going to cover.
So no technical background is required. No statistical background is required. I think curiosity is required. Just people have to be interested in how, in the first day, data is changing individuals, data is changing society. And on the second day, March 9th, it is about how data is changing organizations. What do we need to do? And I'm very interested in those things.
Right.
And I want to make it a good experience. What I should say is that this form, I'm not sure whether we have computer access here. Otherwise, I just tell you again, it's bit.ly, B-I-T, .ly/sassindata. That's where I put up a Google form, and I ask people you know, a few questions beforehand, which I think is super important that they think about it. So among those questions is, what is a data surprise you have had in the last year?
Data surprise.
Yeah. So for me, it was that somebody got recommended to me on Facebook who I haven't seen for like 40 years. We played the cello together in orchestra. This, how would Facebook know that? Then what is a data success story your company had, or you had in your company? And what is a data failure story, and why did it fail?
Right.
And then I think what we see is that, you know, it's the same few number of archetypical stories which will come up. And I did a workshop in April last year, a three-day workshop for Siam Cement Groups, SCG. And that was actually very good on digital transformation.
Right.
So I think it is getting people in the mindset which decisions depend on data, and sharing with me some of their success stories, some of failures. That is how we make the course a good course.
Wow.
And I'm pretty set for the first day. For the second day, it partly depends on what we do in the first day.
Yeah. All right, got it. Thank you so much. So again, from the screens, you can have a QR code. You can take a photo as well. If you're interested, please enroll. Actually, I want to tell you that the seat is getting low, so you need to be hurried. Again, you know, I think today, I'm actually very impressed, right? I think, you know, I have learned a lot from you too, right? You share, I think, a wonderful story. And not only that, I think you also motivate people, right? You know, changing mindset is not something easy, but it's something you have to really believe in it, and that's how you start by doing it. So, ladies and gentlemen, please give Dr. Andreas a big round of applause.
Mm-hmm.
I have a small token of appreciation. I have a gift for you.